because that's only the introduction you'll have to listen hard for. Welcome to Summer School 2013 and to this course. I'm Janet Small. Just a quick announcement, please check your cell phones are off or on silent, please. Okay, so this course, Great Zimbabwe in the 21st Century, is presented by Dr. Shadrach Chirikuru. And for the next 3 days, he'll talk you some of the new thinking about the origins and meanings of one of the greatest archaeological sites in Africa, Great Zimbabwe. We are very pleased to have here Dr. Chirikuru at Summer School. He's a respected archaeological scholar with a particular interest in indigenous mining and metallurgy in southern Africa. And he's an expert on Great Zimbabwe and on Mapungubwe. Dr. Chirikuru is a Zimbabwean national and has a string of degrees. He has a BA, a BA Honours, a BCom Finance, he went a little sidetrack, I see, into finance for a while, and an MA and a PhD in archaeology from the University College in London. He's been teaching at UCT's Department of Archaeology since 2007, where he teaches all levels of students from undergraduate to master's levels, as well as supervising theses. He's published extensively in academic journals and in books. He has been part of producing 4 books of his own and presents regularly at conferences and at public events. He's won several research awards and grants and is involved in a number of interesting research projects at the moment. For instance, I can name two of them, Indigenous mining in southern Africa and the Aranyamun shipwreck. Well, I think maybe next summer school perhaps, we'll have to see. So I'm just going to hand over to him for the next 3 lectures. Welcome, Dr. Chirikuru.
Thank you so much for the very kind introduction. And my name is Shadrach. Please don't ask me where Meshach and Abednego are. I am trying to represent them. Anyway, the subjects of the next 3 lectures is Great Zimbabwe. And I assume that many of us have visited the place, because it's only if you cross the Limpopo and go into the province that is known as Limpopo North. It's a port called Beitbridge. Then 250 kilometers, you are at Great Zimbabwe. Today, I'm very happy to be giving this lecture, also because our boys perhaps are going to be men. I mean, Bafana Bafana. At least they managed to do something. But away from that trivia, Great Zimbabwe, who built it? And how did it emerge? Why did it decline? And more importantly, what do we know about life at Great Zimbabwe? And the interpretations do change with time. What is the current, or what are the current dominant interpretations regarding our understanding of Great Zimbabwe? In the next 3 lectures, I will be trying to give answers to this set of questions. Perhaps I also forgot to tell you that names do have a meaning. As you know, Great Zimbabwe gave its name to the country that is known as Zimbabwe. But somebody was making an unfortunate parallel that well, because as we can see from the photograph there that Great Zimbabwe is in ruins, they have the parallel for the country is that it's also now in ruins. But I didn't say it. Well, this is a map of Great Zimbabwe, sorry, of the Zimbabwe plateau. And this is South Africa, so that would be Limpopo province. The iconic place of Mapungubwe and Great Zimbabwe is just here, which is in the south central of the country. So that is the focus of our study. As you can see, this is a map adapted from Peter Garlick's 1973 book. These triangles, dots, and so forth, they are all archaeological sites which do resemble Great Zimbabwe. It's just that they are not as big as Great Zimbabwe. That's why we don't don't emphasize them in academic discourse, but nevertheless, they are very important. So, going back to the basics, what is Great Zimbabwe? And Great Zimbabwe is the name of an Iron Age town that thrived between around AD 1200 and the mid 16th century AD. As we saw from that map, it is located in south central Zimbabwe. The main issue around Great Zimbabwe is that the people who built it did not have ways of permanently recording their memories, such as writing. As such, the people who live in that area, they have some traditions, but as we know, oral traditions, they are limited. And as such, archaeology is our principal source of information in terms of understanding the site. So the fact that the people who built Great Zimbabwe left no physical written records, that people who started investigating it came around the 19th century, it meant that there is a lot of speculation associated with the origins and life at Great Zimbabwe. The oral traditions also do not help, in as much as they establish a connection between the last rulers at Great Zimbabwe and those who founded what is known as the Mutapa State in northern Zimbabwe. We don't know whether that was the case for sure. So archaeology is our principal source of information. Nevertheless, what I'm going to give you is a synthesis that draw from archaeology, anthropology, as well as the oral traditions. So from the remains, the stone walls and the other areas such as middens or rubbish dumps and the archaeological objects in general, we know that Great Zimbabwe was at least 720 hectares in size. So that's quite extensive. And it also had extensive contact with the Indian Ocean, linking it to places such as China and so forth. So today we may complain of the Chinese influence, but at least one can say it's historical. It goes back quite a while. The inhabitants of Great Zimbabwe worked metals such as iron, gold, copper. They also worked elephant ivory, they built in stone. They made cloth out of bark and kept both a small stock and large stock. And they also believed in life after death. Just a sec, sorry. Just to also emphasize the point that. I like singing, but this was way too much. also to mention that Great Zimbabwe has been a battleground for a wide variety of ideas, and I'll just perhaps briefly comment on that. This is Great Zimbabwe for those of us who haven't been there. These are the major areas. The Great Enclosure in late 19th and early 20th century literature, this is referred to as the elliptical building. This is perhaps the most impressive building at the site. Archaeologists estimate that at least no less than 2 million blocks of nicely chiseled granite were used to build this. The tallest or the highest part of the wall is this area here, which is the back. That area with the chevron pattern is 11 meters high, and it's also 2 meters wide. So it means that if you drive those small cars, such as my smart car, you can drive on top of this wall. But not those very big American ones. That one perhaps you won't make. So the Great Enclosure, a key component of the site. There are these other ruins here, which are known as the plateau regions.
consisting of, there is what is known as the number one ruin, the Render's ruin, and so on and so forth. And there's also another key component here, the Valley of Ambrosius, and there's also the Eastern ruins here. Then there is the hill complex. You can see part of the wall here. So that's another key component of Great Zimbabwe. So Great Zimbabwe is made up of those parts, the hill complex here, the Great Enclosure, and the valley enclosures. So in terms of the sequence and development of the site, the evidence suggests that settlement started here, and there was a gradual occupation of these other areas, but perhaps we will discuss that tomorrow. So actually, I went ahead of myself. This is just a map showing what we were talking about here. These are the components of the different components of Great Zimbabwe. And several archaeologists have come up with different meanings. You can also get an idea of who was involved with archaeological research at Great Zimbabwe. For example, does anybody know who this guy is here?
Yes.
No. Who is he?
He was a German. He went there, I don't know which year, but one of the earliest people, Karl Mauch.
Yes, Karl Mauch, who was a German explorer. He was a geologist, and he is believed to be the first European to draw the attention of Great Zimbabwe to the world. So indeed, these Mount ruins, they are named after him. He was actually directed by this very colorful figure here, Renders, who was a local trader, married locally. And so it is origin has back when Coleman went to Adam Renders. He said, well, if you want to go to Great Zimbabwe, it's there. And Coleman said, why don't you try and show me, he said, well, the beer I'm drinking is too good. I don't think I can show you. So off went Coleman. And there's also Hosselt, and this camp ruin is named because there was a British South Africa company camp here at Great Zimbabwe. So there's a lot of history that you can read from this map of Great Zimbabwe, and also from the names of these enclosures. One of the most important points to understand when discussing not just Great Zimbabwe, but perhaps the Iron Age in Southern Africa, and perhaps in Africa as a whole, is the interplay between the past and the present, in as far as it affects how knowledge is produced. Because what we call knowledge passes through a lot of filters, cultural, academic, and so on and so on. Not surprisingly, as archaeologists, we make interpretations in the present and are trying to understand those communities that existed in the past. Not surprisingly, according to the archaeologist Martin Hall, the past is hardly neutral. And he believes that artifacts do not speak for themselves. I will try to substantiate on this point using the changing interpretations of Great Zimbabwe. And the Canadian archaeologist Bruce Trigger, he came up with three types of contexts that he say they can affect our understanding of any archaeological site. And I'm sure some of you have gone onto the internet and tried to Google, just Googling Great Zimbabwe, and you would be amazed at the kinds of information that comes up. Some say it was built by Phoenicians, others say, well, it was the biblical gold fields of Ophi, and so on. But now, we no longer believe in that. All those interpretations, they are shaped by the social context in which an archaeologist or in which a researcher is working. So Bruce Trigger came up with what he called colonialist archaeology, which would be are practiced during the time of colonialism, and also nationalist archaeology and world-oriented or imperialist archaeology. Why am I bringing up these things in a study of Great Zimbabwe? The reason why I'm bringing these things is that Great Zimbabwe initially was studied during the colonial period, and different mindsets and interpretations were dominant then. And also after independence, actually in any television newsroom in Zimbabwe, you will see the walls of Great Zimbabwe. So it's indeed a nationalist icon, and it has been adopted for all those kinds of interpretations. Pete Robachiro also said that what we call best practice in archaeology is a product of the interaction between social, political, economic, and other factors. Even on Wednesday, when I give you what I would call or what I consider to be the current interpretation of Great Zimbabwe, you should also know that I'm also influenced by all these forces, the social, the political, the economic, and other factors. So that's how knowledge is generated, and that's how we pass on knowledge to our future generations. So what has changed about our understanding of Great Zimbabwe, or what has not changed? We were told that Karl Marx was one of the first visitors to Great Zimbabwe. And what did Karl Marx think when he saw Great Zimbabwe? He immediately thought that, wow, it was not local in origin. Some other race could have built it. So it's not surprising that this is one of the books that was produced in the early 20th century. These are the people, the so-called exotic races that were believed to have built Great Zimbabwe. You can see one of these locals is actually abiding the queen. That was the social context that was prevailing at that point in time. Hence, in the late 19th century and a greater part of the early 20th century, it was believed that Great Zimbabwe was not local in origin. It was authored by races such as Arabs, Semites, and so on. I also have this quotation here that perhaps we cannot blame all these Colmar and others for having what we may call speculative beliefs, because I don't know how true this statement is, but there might be some grain or two of truth in that. Every man, maybe he meant to say every woman as well. Every man calls a barbarian anything that he is not accustomed to. Is this true? If you think we are not conversant with something else, then it's not civilized. It's not, you know. Maybe if that is a human trait, well, we have to again factor it into the context of knowledge production at Great Zimbabwe. So the main point from this slide is that in the late 19th century and early 20th century, it was believed that Great Zimbabwe was not local in origin. It was built by the Phoenicians or the Arabs, and even the Semites. So what happened is that all the local people only came to occupy the site after it was abandoned by its original inhabitants. That also affected the excavation strategy that was taken by researchers such as Richard Hall and Theodore Abend. I just wrote an article actually talking about the life of Theodore Bent as his wife. It was actually very good looking at how those guys understood the world at that point in time. So what happened is that Richard Hall, Theodore Bent, they dug Great Zimbabwe, and when they found material which was not consistent with that exotic interpretation, they simply threw it away. So they said that that material demonstrated, you know, the occupation of or the desecration of Great Zimbabwe to quote Richard Wall, he said that that material was of recent Kefa origin and decadence. So it was no use in trying to understand the site. But thanks to Roger Summers and others, that we have managed to salvage something. I'm not so sure which one is Richard Hall here, but maybe this one. I'm saying maybe, don't quote me. What we are seeing in this slide is these gentlemen who had excavated Great Zimbabwe, and these are all gold objects which they found from the ruins. Let's also not forget that Richard Hall was hired by Cecil John Rhodes to establish what was known as the Ancient Ruins Company, which was formed with the sole purpose of prospecting for gold in these ancient ruins. And you can see, judging by the price of gold at the moment, perhaps these guys could be in the mine if it was in the present, isn't it? So this also compromised a lot of archaeological deposits, and as such, a lot of information was lost. This is an image of the hill complex, and this is a plan from Peter Garlick's book. You can see this is probably the original deposit, and Richard Wall, Theodore Bennett, and others, they dug all these sections. I'm going to give you another view of this. So all this material, all these deposits, it was just thrown away. Some of it we don't know where it was dumped. Hence, even us archaeologists today, we speculate on what was in these deposits. We are confronted with big problems in terms of trying to resolve how was the archaeological sequence in this area. Largely because when Keith Robinson started excavating in the 1950s, 1958 to be precise, he started from these lower levels. And he made the point that he is missing all this information. So that's the results of the earlier work at Great Zimbabwe, compromising future attempts to understand the site. So this is a photograph. If you have been to Great Zimbabwe in the last, or even maybe 15 or 20 years, I'm sure you have seen this. This is again the same hill complex, and these are all deposits of stratified layers of one on top of the other of earth flows and debris. The whole thing is perhaps at least 4 meters from one section where Keith Robinson measured. So some of what was happening in here we don't know, and actually there is no inventory or database that consists of, or that contain all the material from Great Zimbabwe is scattered across the whole world. Some of it is a physical, other material is in Germany, and some is in Zimbabwe. So the good thing about all these activities is that they prompted what was known as the British Society for the Advancement of Science to second a professional archaeologist, David Randall MacIver, to come and rest the issue of the origins of Great Zimbabwe once and for all. That resulted in David Randall MacIver excavating at Kami, Abdodo, and other places, including Great Zimbabwe. And based on the imported material, such as Chinese ceramics, Indian glass beads, David Randall MacIver concluded that Great Zimbabwe was medieval in date, and that was key in trying to argue that the site was local in origin. But protagonists of Randall MacIver, such as Richard Hall, they claimed that, well, without absolute dates, how do you know? And as such, David Randall MacIver could not sway established popular opinion at the time. The activities of Richard Hall continued until in 1930, or 1929 to be specific. The British Society for the Advancement of Science seconded Gertrude Caton Thompson, who was a professional archaeologist who had worked with the world-renowned Cephalidas pottery in Egypt and in Palestine. So after Gertrude Cardon Thompson's work, she concluded that Great Zimbabwe was a local in origin, and indeed the stone walls were built by local people. And in 1958, Keith Robinson, Roger Summers, and an architect known as Andoni Witty, they tried to find sections somewhere here which were not disturbed by a band or a Richard Gore, and they excavated, coming up with a sequence of occupation at Great Zimbabwe. And then, lucky enough, in 1949, Willard Libby, a Nobel-winning chemist based in Chicago, had discovered radiocarbon dating. So one of the earliest samples to be radiocarbon dated in the world was from Great Zimbabwe. And Willard Libby's dates, two of them gave a date of AD 500 and something, but his next dates were quite consistent with the evidence from imports. So that's what led the scholarly and the scientific community to actually believe that, well, even if it is in the absence of written records, at least the material culture and the absolute dates from radiocarbon dating, they do suggest that Great Zimbabwe was a local in origin. But despite that, you find one or two things coming up. So like the latest, there's somebody called Anita Wade, who is saying that Great Zimbabwe was a lunar observatory. So you would still find all these things in the literature. Basically, using triangulation and some mathematical techniques, he says that you can stand here and you can see stars. I don't know how it works, but that's what we are told. But at least the most serious people believe that Great Zimbabwe was indeed a local in authorship. So the question that you might be having at this point in time is that, how did Great Zimbabwe emerge? What are the factors that caused Great Zimbabwe's rise? And indeed, how did it decline? Of course, we know that all empires rise to collapse. It happened to the Roman Empire, and it happened to all those other empires. But talking about the origins of Great Zimbabwe, we can say that based on the archaeological evidence that has been gathered in southwestern Zimbabwe, northeastern Botswana, parts of northern South Africa, where we have the site of Mapungubwe, and where Great Zimbabwe itself is, we can say that the foundation for the establishment of Great Zimbabwe were laid between AD 900 and AD 1000. During this time, the communities that were in southern Africa, some of them, they were practicing mixed farming, and they were settling, they were settled in permanent villages, some of them along watercourses or on hilltops. This is the period that is known as the Iron Age. So we are getting towards the end of what is known as the Early Iron Age. Those of us who have done history, we may know that there were the Bani migrations around AD 200. Whether we believe in them or not, that's another thing. But we can say that there were Bani migrations responsible for the introduction of settled life, metallurgy, crop agriculture, and the keeping of cattle and small stock. So once these people were settled, their populations continued to grow, and they started to trade with one another, as well as initiating contact with the Indian Ocean. The earliest glass beads that we have in Southern Africa, they date to around AD 700. And the chemistry suggests that they were coming from Indonesia. So from that time, towards the late first millennium AD, we see the establishment of trade and exchange relationships between the groups that were living here, as well as with regions outside Southern Africa. And then around AD 900, AD 1000, we see the emergence of very, very large villages some of them which had stone walls, and even the amount of glass beads has also increased at this point in time. So archaeologists call the communities that were living at this point in time the Lepidoscopy people. Lepidoscopy is just an archaeological creation. It is a name of a place that is 22 kilometers from the modern-day town of Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. So if we, those of us who have been to Kami, so if you are at the hill complex at Kami, Lepidoscopy is just a kilometer away towards the direction of Kami Prison. So that's the name of that hill. That's where the material culture, which is consistent with all these communities, was initially found. So in keeping with the archaeological tradition, the place that you find the first material, it then gives its name to everything else that comes after. So that's why we are talking of the Lepidoscopy. Also, do not forget that we do not know the names of these people, because they could not write and they did not leave anything in terms of something that can tell us who their names were and what their communities were. So these Lepidoscopy communities, as I intimated, they also cultivated crops. They worked ivory. There's also evidence from places in the Shashlik-Mpopo, K2, and as well as Schroeder. You can talk of Tollsberg in Botswana. So it's that whole landscape which was networked within internally and within the developments that were taking place in the Indian Ocean. So by about AD 400, some places were more successful than others and had managed to build or to establish vast centers. Great Zimbabwe is one of these. Makungubwe is another. You can also talk of Kami, and there are other places in northeastern Botswana such as those. Historians, archaeologists, and anthropologists have put forward a number of factors that they think explain the rise of Great Zimbabwe. One of the most important factors is the ecological or environmental factors. Tom Huffman, who is an archaeologist, used to be based at the University of the Big Bantustan, and before that he used to work at a museum in Harare. He has done a lot of work in the Shashlik-Mpopo area, particularly in the near the junction between the Limpopo and the Shashi River. That's the locality of the site of Makungubwe. So he has gathered climatic data, and he argues that around 1290, or towards the end of the 13th century AD, there was a drought associated with a global phenomenon known as the Little Ice Age. Current data suggests that even researchers themselves are not agreed on whether the Little Ice Age existed or not. But let's just assume that it happened. And according to the environmental factors paradigm, around AD 1290, or shortly before then, there was a drought which led to a mass migration, or which led to the decline of a place known as Makungubwe in modern-day Limpopo. So that drought led to a migration to the location where Great Zimbabwe is, where people established a vibrant center. How then do we explain the fact that if there was a drought in the Shashlik-Mpopo, why is it that there was no drought some 200 kilometers away? The answer is that Great Zimbabwe is in an area which has got a microclimate, and indeed the data that Huffman has gathered suggests that at least the climate there was sufficient or was optimal to sustain a typical farming and cattle keeping way of life. But dominant as the model has been for the last few years, it is now being heavily questioned with some people calling it a little bit outdated. This is because the evidence is suggesting that the Little Ice Age perhaps did not affect this part of the world as much as it did in communities in Europe. And also, a new settlement study, which was done by some of Tom Hafner's students, is showing that even around 1290, we see many communities moving into the Ashashi-Limpopo area. So therefore, based on common sense, if such a thing exists, it would mean that the environment would not be that bad. Otherwise, why would people move into an area which is not, which cannot sustain them? But nevertheless, this is one of the reasons that researchers have put forward. Then there is the issue of agriculture. Great Zimbabwe is situated in a very good agricultural country with very rich soils. It's also near permanent water supplies. There is a river, actually about a kilometer to the north, where Lake Kyle or Lake Vitiriqui is. So all those factors, they were crucial in supporting and sustaining a growing population. And indeed, many researchers do admit that agriculture was very important, but also argue that it may not be the only cause of Great Zimbabwe's rise. So we can just put it into the basket of factors together with others. Then there's also religion. This issue of religion is based on anthropological work, is based on ethnographic work, which demonstrates that religion plays an important role in the life of Shona people. And not surprisingly, it is believed that Great Zimbabwe may have started as an important religious center where a few individuals used their powers to establish a control over others. There are a number of objects, such as figurines of cattle, figurines of human beings, and which were recovered in contexts that would suggest their association with the ritual. So for that reason, and because those contexts date to around AD 400 or thereabout, archaeologists have argued that perhaps religion was very important in the rise of Great Zimbabwe. The other factor which closely fits with religion is that of rain making. It is argued that the individuals who established Great Zimbabwe may have started as people who could make rain. Remember, I just mentioned that there was a drought in the around 1890. And as such, the people who were in Great Zimbabwe, some of them, they had these powers to make it rain. And because of that, they managed to establish a following, and with that, a very important state. This is based on Tom Hartman's 2009 paper. He argues that indeed rain making was very important for the establishment of Great Zimbabwe. Then, one of the things that is clear from the archaeology of Great Zimbabwe is that even during its flourishing, Great Zimbabwe was indeed an important religious center. There are those eight soapstone beds which are believed to have been used in communicating with the ancestor world. All this is very possible, and to some it may be convincing, but my footnote is just that this is difficult to verify. Again, we need to put this into the basket of factors. The other reason is cattle raising. Say that Great Zimbabwe is situated in a great cattle-keeping country. It is on the edge of the plateau. And as such, Great Zimbabwe would have had access to both the sweet and the sour belt. And the archaeologists who have excavated at Great Zimbabwe have actually come to the conclusion that most of the bone from the site is mainly from Akeko. And based on the ethnography, archaeologists have also reached the conclusion that the rulers controlled large herds of cattle and would have used them as a springboard to political power. And Peter Gallick is indeed one of those archaeologists who have argued that cattle formed the base of the economy at Great Zimbabwe. Just in case we don't know some of the small stuff, that's what goats look like. And this is what cattle look like as well. And they would have been important for Great Zimbabwe's rise. Let me spend 1 or 2 minutes on this slide, which I got from Peter Gallick's 1978 paper, Pastoralism and Zimbabwe. So Peter Gallick's argument is that this is Great Zimbabwe here, and this is also the plateau, and this is now the lowveld. So his distribution map is telling us that all of these archaeological sites, they are located on the edge of the plateau, near the lowveld. And this line here, which looks like a railway line or something of the sort, he says that that's the limit of those nasty things called tsetse flies. So tsetse flies are not good for cattle because they are associated with that disease, trichostomiasis, and people would not have wanted it. So according to Gallick, these senders were strategically placed to make sure that when it was favorable, they could take advantage of this pasturage here. And when it was not, they could also graze their cattle here, but mindful of this tsetse fly. And he has done that with a number of archaeological sites in Mozambique, this place here, Manikeni, and in the north here. And Gallick thought that indeed cattle was one of those important factors that explain the rise of this. Gallick was also saying that perhaps local factors were more important than external factors. I will talk about external factors shortly. But the main point from this map is that the location of places such as Great Zimbabwe was determined by the need one to access both the sweet and sour belt, and two, the distribution of tsetse flies, because they would have been detrimental to cattle herds. Then the other issue that contributed to the rise of Great Zimbabwe is gold mining and trade. So it is believed that Great Zimbabwe controlled gold production and trade, and it exchanged it with the Indian Ocean seaboard and amassed significant amounts of wealth. So most Zimbabwe type places, this is a map from Roger Summers, which shows some of those places such as Great Zimbabwe here. We can think of many more like Kami, and these are all gold formations. Those of us who know the geology of modern day Zimbabwe, this is where places such as Rainbow Mine are, which is a modern day gold producing mine. So gold production is indeed one of those factors. Gold production, we can link it with long distance trade. Long distance trade between Great Zimbabwe and the Indian Ocean, which was primarily channeled via the port of Sofala near what is now modern-day Beira. So Great Zimbabwe supplied ivory, copper, grain, and other local resources. And in turn, it obtained glass beads, porcelains, and so on. These exotic objects were then used in establishing and negotiating power relations. So most archaeologists seem to lean more on this long-distance trade. One of the interesting finds of, or one of the most interesting evidence of long-distance trade is this coin, which was excavated from Great Zimbabwe in 1974. I cannot read Arabic. I am sure maybe we may have one or two among us who can also read Arabic.
But here, according to Tom Huffman, who excavated it, he says that what is being written here bore resemblance to this name, Al-Hasan bin Sulaiman, who was a sultan of Kirwa between 1820 and 1833. So Great Zimbabwe did not have a coinage of its own, and indeed the existence of this coin does indicate that indeed there was a conduct between the Indian Ocean region as well as the interior communities based at Great Zimbabwe. Whether that was based on the presence of people, the physical movement of people, meaning the Arab nations from Kirwa right up to Great Zimbabwe or not, is only a question of speculation. But what this coin does indicate is that at least there was a contact, and there are many types of artifacts that speak to the same point. Inasmuch as long-distance trade, we have been evolving, introducing new forms of wealth, which were used by the elites as leverage for political purposes, the trade stimulus hypothesis is very weak in that it also downplays the importance of local factors. For example, as Gallic has argued, he says that for the long-distance trade to work, you need a very strong local agricultural base. And without that, it is difficult to see how then a long-distance trade would have led to the rise of a place such as Great Zimbabwe. So I think it's neither here nor there with respect to the factors that led to the rise of Great Zimbabwe. But what we can say is that all those factors interacted and contributed to the rise of Great Zimbabwe as we know it today. They say that everything that has got a beginning has got an end, and so it is going to be my lecture for today. But before then, Great Zimbabwe started to decline from around AD 1550. The reasons for that are mainly ecological. It had a very large population, 20,000 people. Those would have resulted in environmental degradation. The agricultural base could not sustain the population, and as such, the place was abandoned. Oral traditions claimed that there was a shortage of salt, which precipitated the then ruler by the name of Nyasimbam Toja to go and settle in the north of the country, establishing what is known as the Mutava state. But the other reasons also include the shifting trade routes. The northern part of Zimbabwe is rich in alluvial gold, and it's also closer to the Zambezi River. So if we are talking of 1550, the Portuguese were already on the Indian Ocean. So that sort of diverted and shifted the trade to the Zambezi. And with that, Great Zimbabwe lost control over gold production and trade, leading to its decline. From the 16th and 17th century, Great Zimbabwe continued to be occupied on a smaller scale and was used for religious purposes. Even today, it is still being used for religious purposes. So in 2008, when things were really very bad in Zimbabwe, one traditional healer said that she had visions that there was a gold stashed underneath the conical tower in the Great Enclosure. So she appealed to the powers that be, that if she was allowed to excavate that, then the petrol problems and everything that the country was undergoing would go away. But fortunately for the scholarly community, Gertrude Carroll Johnson has established one or two trenches, and we knew, or people knew, that at least there was no gold. So the administrators said that, well, thanks, but no thank you. On this note, let me take one or two questions. Yes?
Would you perhaps like to proportions of Bertrand Cotterill are very significant in building and engineering terms.
Are you an architect by profession?
No,
I'm an engineer. Oh, I see. Tomorrow morning, my first class is in the faculty of the built environment, discussing the architecture of this park. Let's find this. Where are we? So it is believed that, or let me rephrase myself, this is a granite formation. And there are many of these around Great Zimbabwe, particularly this site. That's where those chalets are. So the researchers who have worked at Great Zimbabwe have actually found some quarries where they believe that the granite was obtained from. And there was also some experimental replication which was done to try and understand how the individual blocks were made. So the technique of quarrying would have been fire setting, coupled to heating the rock and then pouring water to make sure that it cracks, and then they would hammer it to produce some nice blocks. So, for example, this great enclosure, the blocks are almost standard, and that also passes comment on the control of labor of the people who were doing that. So in terms of quarrying the granite which was used to make this, it was quarried locally, and as I said, archaeologists have found places where they believe that the people who built the Great Zimbabwe were obtaining their raw material. There is evidence that a fire setting was used to loosen the rock, so they would heat it and then maybe pour some water. If it cracks, then they would hammer it into small blocks and shape it to size. I must say that the level of standardization, particularly for the Great Enclosure and the Valley Enclosure, is actually very, very impressive. Yes?
Is there any evidence that there was trade relations between Great Zimbabwe and the Benin civilization in the 15th century? Because it seemed that it all came from the Indian Ocean. Was there any?
Yes. I have that map here now, but maybe tomorrow I will have it. So the trade at Great Zimbabwe was occupied for, let's say, from AD 1000 to around 1000, let's say 1550. So what you can see is that by looking at the changes in imported materials, they tell you the regions that it was traded with. So around AD 1000, the glass beads actually point to the fact that they were having much contact with Fustat in Egypt. Fustat, I think below Cairo, and the Persian world. And there are these fluctuations, such that by maybe 1300 or thereabouts, it goes back to India. So there are fluctuations as far as the imports can tell, and that shows that we can actually correlate the changing nature of those imports at Great Zimbabwe with events that were taking place in the greater Indian Ocean region area, including all those places that you have mentioned, but at different points in time.
The Benin civilization was in Nigeria,
which is on the west. No. But they were all networked. They were all interlinked to what was happening in the Indian Ocean region. So, for example, we looked at the glass beads from Igbo Ugu in southern Nigeria, and their chemistry and trace elements and so forth, they are identical from those which were found at Mapungubwe. So we can say that, well, it would be difficult to say that they were in contact, but we know that they were trade routes from Nigeria via the Sahara into North Africa and Egypt. So that's why I'm saying that all these events that were taking place, they were networked, but they may have taken a different route.
What is the population roughly at its maximum?
Anything from 2,000 to 20,000. 2,000 people to 20,000 people, depending on who you read. If you read Peter Garlick, then he says it's 2,000. If you read Tom Huffman, initially he said 18,000, but now he says it's 20,000. And how they arrived at those estimates is that they looked at the number of huts or houses in here. So Peter Garlick says this one would have accommodated at least 45 huts. So if it has 45 houses, each household can have how many people? Let's say 5. And then based on those simple computations, you just extrapolate for the whole site. So that's how they arrived at those estimates. But nobody is sure. Yes.
What would have prompted the people to build stone enclosures but live in mud huts?
A number of reasons explain that. These stone walls, as you can see, they are screening stone walls, meaning that we can associate them with prestige. So the commoners cannot gather. So if you guys are the commoners and I was the elite, what I would do is that I would simply build a wall so that you guys cannot see how us the elite enjoy life, isn't it? and also it's ideological. It's also associated with the need to demonstrate power. Nevertheless, the mud that was used to make these houses, it's also very, 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 very strong. It's what some researchers have called Zimbabwe cement. It's very, very, very hard. And I think I've only seen it at places associated with Great Zimbabwe and nowhere else. It's a pity that nobody has done some research into how that Zimbabwe cement was made. But it is very, very, very hard. So the expectation then would be that perhaps those mud brick structures would also have been of a high quality. Yes?
The peoples who migrated in 1290 and thereabouts from the Mapungubwe areas and areas like Tulamela, they went north. Would they have been Shona? What would the language and cultural differences have been from those people? Or are they from the same stem?
I'll try to give a more balanced answer. The first being that Tulamela is Tulamela post-date Greensboro.
Oh, post-date?
Yes, post-date Greensboro. But Mapungubwe, 1290, as I mentioned, that the thinking that there was a migration from Mapungubwe to Great Zimbabwe is problematic for a number of reasons. The first one is that at the same time we see new groups of people coming into the Shashi-Limpopo Basin where Mapungubwe is. So in terms of a density count, we see more archaeological sites at that same time, which shows that people were not moving away. The people would have been Shona. That's what Tom Huffman tells us. The material culture belongs to that group of people that I have said is laparoscopic. So if Tulamela, the lower horizons, the material belongs to an archaeological phase known as Mutamba, which is the same as Mapungubwe. So that's the same time horizon. But whether there was a migration or not, we can put a very big question mark on that. But if they migrated, then they were shorter. And if they didn't, the people who were in Great Zimbabwe were still shorter, because it's still that same landscape, which extends to the margins of the Kalahari, where we have archaeological sites, which are the same as Mapungubwe, the same as Great Zimbabwe, with rolling evidence of extractive commodities, and so on and so on. One of the major limitations of our discipline, archaeology, is that if a place has not been discovered or investigated, then it doesn't exist. So there are many, many, many of those sites. We don't know what is really happening. So if I was still young, I would say maybe when I grow up, I would like to go and work at those sites. But unfortunately, I can't. It's just
there are some allegations against them. So there is a lot that we don't know. And we also want to be very intelligent. So when I'm talking to you guys, what I should be doing is giving you a very neat synthesis, which gives you an impression that, like, wow, this is what things were like. But maybe today I decided to be a lot more honest than usual. Yes.
Burial sites that would give you any indication of the number of people living there?
Oh, that's another very interesting topic. Well, my first time to Zimbabwe was when I was a school kid, and my home area is probably about 100 kilometers towards the north. So when we came here, we also asked the same person, are there any burials? And our tour guide told us that, look, do you see this area here? This is what is known as Lake Kyle, or what is now Lake Itiribi. So our tour guide said, well, we haven't found any burials, but we think that they may have existed, but they are now flooded by the water. Yes.
Were there any graves discovered
around? Yes, there are one or two skeletons and one or two associated with gold, but not as many as at Makungugwe or Keju. So there is very little in terms of mortuary evidence. So that's why also speculation has been very rife, because people were saying, well, we have the burials, we have the people, and some intelligent amongst us, as I told you, they said, well, the burials were there, but they are just submerged in water, so maybe we can go and dive in. It should be quite fun, isn't it? Okay, let's take two more questions, and then we can continue tomorrow. Yes? Zimbabwe is a Shona word meaning houses of stone. It first appears in the Portuguese records of the early 16th century, in particular the chronicler Antonio Pocaro, and he says that the kings in this country, they live in walled settlements which they call Zimbabwe. So actually in some cases you find it as Zimbabwe with a DZI. And as I mentioned later on, the nationalist movement decided to give the name of the country from Great Zimbabwe. They just say, well, it's Zimbabwe, meaning houses of stone. Well, thank you, everybody. See you tomorrow.